instance, was in the West Bank, despite having full and maximum control over it, despite having the PA as the enforcers, they cannot stem the tide of resistance. And this is something that they need to acknowledge, understand, recognize, and realize that you cannot continue with this oppression. The time is limited.
Mr. Nahvi, we're almost out of time. We have maybe less than a minute if you want to add any closing comments to the program.
Yes. It is quite clear that Israel is as weak as a spider's web. It has never been this weak before. We are truly seeing the end of the Zionist regime. Alhamdulillah, because of Shahid Qasem Soleimani, the IRGC, and the resistance forces, they have proven that they are independent in their military capabilities, and they are ready to face any kind of oppression from the Zionist regime. They have proven themselves time and time again. Hezbollah has defeated the Zionist regime on many fronts, 2000, 2006, and also their very proxy, which is ISIS, in Syria and in Iraq. The resistance forces are ready
very well
to face the Zionist entity.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. A human rights activist Mohsen Nahvi joining us from Houston, Texas. And thanks to attorney, activist, and political analyst Zakir Ahmed Maye joining us from Johannesburg. A special thanks to you for staying with us on tonight's Spotlight. It's good night for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now, we enlighten you with verses 40 to 43 of chapter Al-Baqarah from the Holy Quran, recited by Ali Parhizgar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. يا بني إسرائيل اذكروا نعمتي التي أنعمت عليكم وأوفوا بعهدي أوف بعهدكم وأوفوا بعهدي أوف بعهدكم وإياي فارهبون وآمنوا بما أنزلت مصدقا لما معكم ولا تكونوا أول كافر به ولا تشتروا بآياتي ثمنا قليلا وإياي فاتقون ولا تلبسوا الحق بالباطل وتكتموا الحق وأنتم تعلمون وأقيموا الصلاة وآتوا الزكاة واركعوا مع الراكعين صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. O children of Israel, call to mind my favor which I bestowed on you, and be faithful to your covenant with me. I will fulfill my covenant with you, and of me alone should you be afraid. And believe in what I have revealed, verifying that which is with you, and be not the first to deny it, neither take a mean price in exchange for my communications. And me alone should you fear. And do not mix up the truth with the falsehood, nor hide the truth while you know it. And keep up prayer, and pay the poor rate, and bow down with those who bow down.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Says any serious dialogue between Syria and Turkey is a positive step for both countries. Demonstrators once again hit the streets of Tel Aviv to protest against the policies of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. And Peru declares a state of emergency in the capital Lima and three other regions due to continued protest over the ouster of the former president. Hello and welcome. Your world news coming to you live from our headquarters in Tehran. My name is Gisum Shahmadi. Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian has visited Syria. Coming from Lebanon, the top diplomat held meetings with top officials covering regional and international developments. Our correspondent Mohammed Ali has the details.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian met Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in Damascus. Assad said Syria is keen on maintaining continuous coordination with Iran, especially now amid rapid regional and international developments. He reiterated that Syria will not press ahead with talks with Turkey unless the goal was to end Turkish occupation in Syria and the support of terrorist organizations. Abdollahian said any serious dialogue between Syria and Turkey is a positive step for both countries and the region, expressing Iran's trust in Syria's stances and decisions. The top Iranian diplomat held separate talks with his Syrian counterpart, Faisal al-Maqdad, focusing on expanding economic and trade relations between both countries. In a joint press conference, Abdullahian touched upon Syrian-Iranian economic ties.
Our relations with Syria are at their best condition. We must exert our utmost efforts to boost economic ties to the level of our political ones. We agreed to prepare a long-term strategic cooperation document to be signed in the near future.
He indicated to Iran's role in preventing a planned Turkish military operation in northern Syria, welcoming diplomatic efforts for ending disputes between the two neighbors. Miqdad said the visit comes at a critical time amid challenges facing Syria.
The visit comes as we face challenges set by the U.S., the West, Israel and their proxies. They don't want the Syrian people to heal. Our relations with Iran are strategic, and soon there will be steps taken that prove the depth of relations and both countries' belief in the necessity of enhancing them.
Miqdad said Syria will not forget the repeated Israeli aggressions, promising at the right time Syria will respond and inflict heavy losses on Israel in a way it will regret all its attacks. Emir Abdullahian's visit is part of a regional tour aimed at evaluating developments with Iran's allies. It's a reminder of the strong ties among member states of the Resistance Alliance, despite decades-long attempts to break them by their enemies. Muhammad Ali, Damascus.
Moving on, an Iranian national with a British passport has been executed for spying for the UK government in, quote, extensive action against Iran's national security. Alireza Akbari was sentenced to death more than 2 years after he was arrested. According to a court ruling, Akbari began working with the UK spy agency and MI6 under the guise of research and trade activities. He had numerous meetings with UK agents in different countries over a long period. He passed on intelligence on key issues, including Iran's domestic and foreign policies, as well as missile and defense programs. Akbari also gave the UK information about nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, who was assassinated in November 2020. Britain has reacted to the execution, saying it will temporarily withdraw its ambassador from Tehran, among other measures.
The UK government made it clear that we would respond, and therefore in response to this execution, we have summoned the Iranian chargé d'affaires. We have imposed sanctions against the prosecutor general, and we have also decided to temporarily withdraw our ambassador for further consultations.
James cleverly says Britain's response will not necessarily be limited to these measures, and the country will try to deter similar action by Iran. Earlier, Iran's foreign ministry summoned the British ambassador to Tehran to lodge protests against what it called uncustomary UK interventions in matters concerning Iran's national security. Fuad Izadi, a university professor and political commentator, says the hysteric reaction of the British government over Akbari's execution stands to reason. He says London knows that it would now be more and more difficult to recruit spies in Iran.
Akbari was, as you reported, a high-ranking official. He was for some time deputy defense minister for international affairs. He was a bureaucrat within the Iranian government. He was not a politician. He was not have expressed any political views. So why would a government would execute a high-ranking official without any reason? The reason was obvious, he engaged in espionage. He confessed to engaging in espionage for the British government. And the reaction of the British government is something that you would expect, because it would be difficult for UK to recruit more spies. Generally, when the spies are recruited, they are told that even if you get caught, they'll get you free through prisoner exchange. So if someone gets caught and then is executed, no prisoner exchange is in sight, then other people who may be thinking about working for a foreign government will think twice.
Iranians are marking the National Women's Week. This comes after Women's Day, the birth anniversary of the Prophet the daughter of the Prophet of Islam, Hazrat Fatima. This occasion focuses on the high status of women in Iran.
Flowers, gifts, and poems. In Iran, it is once again the time of the year to celebrate women, their progress, and their victories. Traditionally, 1 week is designated as Women's Week in Iran, which includes the birthday of Hazrat Fatimeh, the daughter of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, celebrated as Mother's Day.
The days of Women's Week have been named as follows. After Friday, which is of course Mother's Day, the day of women and their role in the family, Saturday is named Women and Virtue, Resisting Western Patriarchy, Sunday, Women and Self-Esteem, Leaders in Scientific Fields, Monday, Women, Creators of the Next Generation, Tuesday, Women, Buoyant, Resourceful and Wise, Wednesday, Women, Security and Social Justice, and Thursday, Women, Hopeful and Faithful.
But this year, Iranians are celebrating Women's Week, while under U.S. pressure, the Islamic Republic was removed from the United Nations Women's Commission, and as foreign-backed rioters have tried to exploit the concept of women and their freedom for their own political gains. So I asked the Vice President how women's status has changed over the past four decades.
After the victory of the Islamic Revolution, women were given more opportunities to take on social roles. Women literacy has increased from 35% four decades ago to 95% today. More than 60% of university students and 30% of faculty members and professors are women. We have over 2,700 NGOs, mostly run by women.
An issue that was also raised by the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution in a special meeting arranged to honor Women's Week. But most importantly, the leader pointed to the fact that solidarity is key, and the issue of hijab should not be exploited to divide women. Women who were present chanted slogans to show that they agree with the leader. And this is what's highlighted Women's Week this year.
The occasion this year is of more significance than ever before. It has become an opportunity to shed light on the fact that the recent foreign-backed riots and the exploitation of women to divide the country was a failed attempt by Iran's enemies. Gisumi Shahmadi, Tehran.
Moving on, a funeral ceremony has been held for two Palestinians killed by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank. Mourners attending the funeral reiterated their pledge to respond to Israeli atrocities. Two Palestinians were shot during an Israeli raid on a village near the city of Jenin. Israeli troops opened fire on a car that they were traveling in. One of the victims was pronounced dead on the spot, while the other later died in hospital. Also, on Saturday, one Palestinian succumbed to wounds that he sustained during an Israeli raid near Jenin earlier this month. The regime has stepped up attacks across the occupied territories in recent months. More than 180 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank since early last year. Our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kendall, explains why the Israeli regime has intensified its crackdown against Palestinians.
It seems that the Israeli military's brutality shows no sign of abating, and is cracking down on not only Palestinian fighters, as we are saying, because they include children, they include civilians as well. The Israelis are targeting as well the general population here in the occupied territories. At the end of the day, Palestinians warn that more aggressive, policies by Israel's current right-wing regime led by Benjamin Netanyahu is expected, because Netanyahu and the Israeli military wants to prove to the Israelis and the settlers in a way or another that they control the Palestinian territories. They would prevent Palestinian resistance, any form of resistance. And in the last year, over 180 Palestinians were killed. Many of them were known as Palestinian fighters, members of the newly formed groups, whether the Jenin, battalion or the Lion's Den in Nablus. So the Israeli regime doesn't want for Palestinians to be engaged in any form of resistance, and they don't want them, of course, to be engaged in confrontations and armed resistance and to shoot at the Israeli soldiers and the settlers.
Tens of thousands of demonstrators have hit the streets in Tel Aviv to protest against the policies of a right-wing cabinet led by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The protesters chanted slogans against Netanyahu and carried banners and signs that read, "Cabinet of Shame" and "Bring Down the Dictator." The demonstration is the biggest since Netanyahu's cabinet took power in late December. Similar rallies were held in Al-Quds in Haifa. Netanyahu returned to power at the head of a coalition with extreme right and ultra-Orthodox parties. The cabinet is planned to hand more powers to lawmakers, appointing judges and overriding the regime's Supreme Court decisions. It has also announced intentions to pursue a policy of settlement expansion in the occupied West Bank. Peru declares a state of emergency in the capital, Lima, and three other regions due to anti-government protests. The measure will be in force for 30 days. It authorizes the army to intervene and maintain order and suspend several constitutional rights, such as freedom of movement and assembly. Peru has been the scene of demonstrations since December following the ouster of former President Pedro Castillo. He is currently in pretrial detention, attempting to dissolve Congress and avoid an impeachment. Protesters want his release and the removal of the current president, Dina Boluarte. Violent protests have so far left 42 people dead and hundreds injured. U.S. police brutality continues to take innocent lives. This time, 31-year-old Kanine Anderson, a teacher, died after being repeatedly tased by Los Angeles police. His death brings to three the number of people killed in encounters with the L.A. police in less than a week. In the United States, California's governor has called on the president to declare a major disaster as floods wreak havoc through the state.
And finally, to the president, and this is important because this is a question that if you aren't asking, you should be asking, is are we going to get that major disaster declaration? And my hope and expectation is we will, because that's the intention of the president. And he made it clear that he wants to see that happen. And I'm looking forward to making that announcement more formally, because that's my response to the folks out there on COTS right now in terms of what are we going to do for them. Reality is this is just the eighth of what we...
Kevin Newsom said the state would see more devastating floods in the form of a natural phenomenon called atmospheric river. He called on citizens to remain vigilant over the next 48 hours. At least 19 people are known to have died from the storm-related causes since late December. The storms have also led to power outages, mudslides, evacuations, and road closures. Tens of thousands of teachers and schools have taken to the streets in the Portuguese capital demanding higher wages and better working conditions. The demonstrators held signs and placards calling for a fair salary and resignation of the education minister. Teachers in Portugal on average make around 2,000 euros a month, which the protesters say is too low, particularly given the cost of living crisis. The Portuguese teachers have held nationwide strikes since early December, leaving many students with no classes. The latest protest is one of the biggest the country has been witnessing in recent years. To Germany now, where police have clashed with climate activists protesting the expansion of a coal mine in the village of North Rhine-Westphalia. Police used tear gas to disperse the crowd in Leut Zara activists are calling on the energy firm RWE to stop its planned demolition of the deserted village. On Wednesday, the firm said it was going ahead with its project to make space for an open-cast coal mine. Earlier this week, hundreds of police also began removing activists holding sit-ins there. Authorities say they are entering the final stage of evacuation, adding that a large part of the protest camp has already been cleared. Germany's climate policy is actually under fire by environmentalists who are accusing the government of taking a back seat on the issue at a time when Europe is facing an energy crisis. And now with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. On Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely Thou art the All-Forgiving, the All-Compassionate.
in the limelight.
Aides to U.S. President Joe Biden have discovered at least one more batch of classified documents in a location separate from a think tank office he used after serving as vice president. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The website MSN.com has covered this story and tells us more. President Joe Biden's legal team found additional classified documents when they searched a second location after finding secret government papers in a different Biden office in early November, according to a person familiar with the investigation. Earlier this week, an attorney for Joe Biden said the president's personal lawyers had discovered a small number of classified documents at the Penn Biden Center for Diplomacy and Global Engagement, an institute in downtown Washington that Joe Biden started after serving as vice president. People familiar with the matter said that that discovery involved about 10 classified documents. Biden's lawyers notified government agencies and the Justice Department opened an investigation to see how the classified material got there and whether there was any other material that should be under government lock and key. Legal representatives for the president found additional classified material at a second location, a person said on Wednesday, 11th of January, speaking on condition of anonymity. The person would not say when the material was found. The second batch of classified material was first reported by NBC News. Spokesmen for the Justice Department, the FBI, and the White House declined to comment. Earlier, a White House spokeswoman refused to say if any additional classified material had been found beyond the batch at the Penn Biden Center. This is under review by the Department of Justice. I'm not going to go beyond what the president shared, White House spokeswoman Karine Jean-Pierre said, declining to respond to several questions about whether additional properties, including Joe Biden's Delaware homes in Wilmington and Rehoboth Beach, had been searched. White House officials have said that they are cooperating with the Justice Department and that Joe Biden's lawyers quickly handed over the documents to the National Archives and Records Administration, the agency tasked with handling of presidential records. A Biden lawyer said the classified documents at the Penn Biden Center were found on 2nd of November, when one of his personal attorneys opened a locked closet to pack up the contents. The White House counsel's office notified the National Archives, which took possession of the documents the following day, a Biden lawyer confirmed. That discovery came not long before Attorney General Merrick Garland appointed a special counsel, Jack Smith, to oversee the agency's criminal investigation into former President Donald Trump's possible mishandling of hundreds of classified documents that were taken to Mar-a-Lago after his presidency ended. Officials have said the investigation of Trump concerns not just the possible mishandling of government secrets, but also possible obstruction of justice or destruction of presidential records. To review the discovery of Biden's classified documents, Merrick Garland tapped U.S. Attorney John Loesch of Chicago, a holdover from the Trump administration. Depending on what his initial investigation yields, Merrick Garland could decide to appoint a special counsel. While the Biden case has obvious echoes of the Mar-a-Lago investigation into Donald Trump's conduct, the details provided by Joe Biden's lawyer on Monday suggested key differences that could factor heavily in whether the Biden documents became a criminal matter. Joe Biden's lawyer, Richard Sober, said the Biden documents were discovered by the president's lawyers and voluntarily turned over to the authorities. By comparison, in Donald Trump's case, the National Archives and Record Administration officials pressed for material to be handed over, and then Donald Trump's office was served with a grand jury subpoena demanding their return. After Trump's lawyers delivered 38 classified documents in response to the subpoena, an FBI search recovered more than 100 additional classified documents that were not turned over to the authorities. Much of the criminal investigation into the keeping of classified documents at Mar-a-Lago, Donald Trump's private club and residence, has centered on what officials have described in court papers as possible obstruction of efforts to recover all of the documents. So far, no such allegation has been leveled in the Biden matter, though it is at an earlier stage. Legal experts say it is not uncommon for some people who have security clearances to mishandle classified documents, but these situations are typically handled administratively and not criminally, because the criteria for prosecuting people who mishandled classified documents include proving the person deliberately flouted rules for how to secure the materials. NBC News has also covered this story. Aides to President Joe Biden have discovered at least one additional batch of classified documents in a location separate from the Washington office he used after leaving the Obama administration, according to a person familiar with the matter. Since November, after the discovery of documents with classified markings in his former office, Joe Biden aides have been searching for any additional classified materials that might be in other locations he used, said the source who spoke on condition of anonymity. The White House did not reply to a request for comment. The Justice Department had no comment to make. The initial discovery of classified documents in an office used by Joe Biden after his vice presidency was first reported on Monday, 9th of January, by CBS News. The classification level, number, and precise location of the additional documents was not immediately clear. It also was not immediately clear when the additional documents were discovered and if the search of any other classified materials Biden may have from the Obama administration is complete. Joe Biden aides have been sifting through documents stored at locations beyond his former Washington office to determine if there are any other classified documents that need to be turned over to the National Archives and Record Administration and reviewed by the Justice Department, the person familiar with the matter has said. The search was described as exhaustive, with the goal of getting a full accounting of all classified documents that may have inadvertently been packed in boxes when Joe Biden cleared out of Vice President's office space in January of 2017. Senator Josh Hawley, a Republican senator from Missouri, reacted on social media just minutes after the NBC News report on the new documents, tweeting out the words special counsel. The White House on Monday, 9th of January, issued a statement confirming that a small number of documents with classified markings that appeared to be from the Obama administration had been found at a Washington think tank tied to Joe Biden. The documents were discovered in a locked closet by Biden's attorney while they prepared to vacate office space at the Penn Biden Center for Diplomacy and Global Engagement. Richard Sober, special counsel to the president, said in a statement on Monday. The University of Pennsylvania had leased a suite of offices for the center in February of 2018, including one for then private citizen Joe Biden's personal use when he was in Washington. Biden told reporters on Tuesday, 10th of January, that he was surprised by the discovery and that he didn't know what was in the documents. The chair and vice chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee have written to Director of National Intelligence Avril Haines, asking for access to the classified documents, a damage assessment by the intelligence community, and a briefing on both the Biden and the Trump documents, three congressional staffers confirmed. This request is similar to how the committee requested information after a raid at Mar-a-Lago, former President Donald Trump's resort in Florida.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Islam.
Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, and welcome to Eye on Islam, the show where we look at stories through an Islamic lens. Each week, we'll take a look at trending news, and this week we're looking at historical stories which have a direct relevance to the religion of Islam, and we'll break it down from a Muslim perspective. Today, we're going to celebrate one of the golden ages of Islamic history, the 800-year period the Muslims ruled over what is modern-day Spain and Portugal. The anniversary of the end of that glorious period falls in the month of January, which is a great opportunity for Muslims to reflect on what made Muslim Spain or Al-Andalus so great.
In January 1492, the last Muslim kingdom of Al-Andalus, better known as Muslim Spain, fell to the Catholic monarchs, putting an end to 800 years of glorious Islamic civilization. The Muslim presence in the Iberian Peninsula was a time when religious tolerance, sophisticated scholarship, glorious architecture, and a superior lifestyle prevailed. Muslim Spain is now best known by the glories of its architecture, such as the Alhambra Palace in Granada, one of Europe's most visited monuments. But it was perhaps the Cordoba Caliphate from the 8th to 11th centuries which personified Al-Andalus at its height, with Muslims, Jews, and Christians all intermingling and flourishing under Muslim rule. By the 15th century, the Christians had begun to squeeze the Muslims. But the real impetus for the fall of Granada was when Ferdinand of Aragon and Isabella of Castile married to unite the two largest Christian kingdoms. These monarchs had a vision of a uniquely Catholic nation. Around 100,000 Muslims were subsequently killed or enslaved, and 200,000 fled. Later, a decree would be ordered, forcing those who remained to convert to Christianity on pain of death. The Catholic monarchs also passed a decree expelling all Jews or forcing them to convert, again on pain of death.
Well, later on in the show, we'll be talking to two experts on Islamic Spain. But first, joining us in the studio today is Roshan Mohamed Saleh, who is the editor of the Muslim news website Five Pillars. Roshan is a very frequent visitor to the historic Muslim areas of modern-day Spain and has kindly agreed to share his experiences with us today. Roshan, welcome to the show. It's great to have you on, as always. Just tell me, what's your view of Islamic Spain? Tell me about your experiences there.
Well, I've been there about 10 times over the years, and the last time was only about a month and a half ago. And I just think it's the most beautiful part of Europe. I think, and especially if you're a Muslim and you're interested in Islamic history, like every Muslim should be, then Andalusia in the southern part of Spain, where the Muslim influence is the strongest, is the place to go. And I could recommend a few places, like Granada is the obvious place with the Alhambra Palace, which is probably the most beautiful monument in Europe. It's just an amazing place, a fortress and several palaces. Then there's the Mesquita or the mosque, the Grand Mosque of Cordoba, which is literally one of the most beautiful mosques in the whole world. And even Masjid al-Nabawi in Medina, it's modelled on the Mesquita in Cordoba, the famous arches. And there are other, you know, beautiful places like there's a fortress in Malaga, there's a Muslim tower in Seville. So it's literally a reminder, and the landscape will remind lots of Muslims of North Africa as well, Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia, you know, mountainous olive trees everywhere. It's just a really beautiful place.
No, I'm pretty embarrassed to say I haven't been yet, unfortunately.
Okay,
I must go. But interesting enough, you've written about the sadness you feel when you visit this region as well. Could you explain that to
me? Yeah, so it's kind of, I always have mixed feelings because I'm really happy to be there. But when you visit some of these Muslim monuments, you know, they've been desecrated by the Christians. After the fall of Granada in 1492, the Catholic monarchs in particular, they had this policy of desecrating Qurans and just generally denigrating Muslim culture. So
forced
the Alhambra...
Forced conversions.
Yeah, exactly. And the Alhambra, for example, they built a kind of a palace, a Christian-style palace right in the middle of the Alhambra, which looks really incongruous next to the Muslim architecture. They did the same thing in the Grand Mosque of Cordoba. They put a Christian cathedral right in the middle of that mosque. So they basically vandalized it. And, you know, when you go to these places, you can't pray, for example, if you try to pray as a Muslim, even though there's a mihrab there, you know, direction of the prayer, you know, you're ready to pray, but they won't let you pray. They'll physically stop you from praying. You could get arrested if you pray. So it's just a reminder of what we lost. And the fact is that we're not allowed to celebrate it properly in modern day Muslim Spain. Spain, rather.
Yes, it's interesting you mention those points because there surely are some Muslims still left in Spain. What's the community like there?
Limited. There's a bit of immigration, kind of like, you know, menial labour from places like Morocco especially, but, you know, Tunisia and other places in North Africa and, you know, sub-Saharan Africa as well. But the Muslim presence in Spain is less than it would be in other European countries like the UK, for example, where we have 4 million plus Muslims, France, where there's 6 million plus Muslims. It's much less. I think it's well under a million in Spain. And that's because there's been a deliberate policy of, you know, kind of keeping the Muslim presence in Spain quite small. Mosques, for example, regularly are denied building permits. There are a few mosques now, but there aren't many mosques. But still, you can see the vestiges of Muslim Spain, and even the faces of the people, because lots of Spaniards, Christian Spaniards, were originally Arabs, and they have Arab blood in them. Even the Spanish language has lots of Arabic words. The food, and it permeates every aspect of life, but sometimes you have to look for it.
Yes, and I know that there are still place names which originate from the Arabic language.
Absolutely.
That haven't changed, that type of thing. And I wonder, very briefly, Roshan, Islamophobia is a European-wide phenomena, it's a problem across the board. But in Spain, would you say that it's worse because of this issue? They're trying to stamp out Muslim culture?
Absolutely. They were doing that because, you know, the policy once 1492 happened, it was eradication of Islam. And that has served as a blueprint for even for modern societies. France is going down that route in many ways, not physical extermination, but extermination of a religion, and lots of European societies. So even the influence of, you know, the Spanish Inquisition, for example, you know, it permeates into modern life even today.
Well, Roshan, we are going to come back to you later on in the show, if I'm not mistaken. But for the time being, I want to move on and take a look at what people on social media have been saying about the anniversary of Al-Andalus and its fall in modern-day Spain.
Twitter has become awash with opinions regarding the legacy of Islamic Spain. Muslims hold Al-Andalus in high regard and praise the period as a shining example of an Islamic region leading in tolerance and enlightenment.
One of the most understudied pieces of human history, the impact this caliphate had on knowledge building alone is tremendous to today's modern society. May this serve as a reminder for all, regardless of religion or culture, to appreciate Muslim contributions to history. Alhamdulillah, since its arrival, Islam has still been there longer than it hasn't. May bring back the Nur that illuminated Europe, and by extension, the world. Ameen.
Some non-Muslims used the occasion to troll Muslims and praise the collapse of Islamic rule in the Iberian Peninsula.
People of Spain are so happy they drove the invaders back to where they belonged. Spain grew to be a great nation and an empire. They helped greatly to push back the Ottomans and keep them away from total defeat of Europe.
While other Muslims believe lessons should be learned about Muslims and their trust for the un-Islamic world.
It's what happens when you sit on your laurels and you're not alerted to the plots of the disbelievers. You have to never trust the disbelievers and must be permanently on high alert to defend yourself and spread your cause. Today again we are trusting them whilst they plot our destruction. Many of the traits for which modern US prides itself comes from Muslim Spain, who achieved these traits first. Diplomacy, free trade, open borders, techniques of academic research, anthropology, fashion, algorithms, medicine, hospitals, etc. But the only thing the West associates us with is terrorism.
Well, I'm honoured to declare that we have another guest joining us now to add to this discussion, Dr. Uthman Latif, a celebrated Muslim author, a renowned historian, teacher and lecturer based here in Britain. Assalamu alaikum, Doctor. Thank you so much for joining us on the show. Now, firstly, just start off by telling us why you think Islamic Spain was so great in your view.
I think for a few reasons. One, because Spain is recognised as Al-Andalus. In fact, that period is called by historians as the convivencia, as the coexistence between Muslims, Jews and Christians, an unparalleled kind of moment in human history where Jews, Christians and Muslims could thrive under Islamic rule in Islamic Spain. So we have, of course, a great kind of legacy of achievement under great rulers like Uthman III, Al-Hakam II, the building of schools, of universities, of hospitals, of mosques, of makatib, of all of these things. But I think that that period, in fact, is very unique in human history because it represents kind of like you might call a golden age of civilization in Islam, but also, in fact, in Judaism. It's also seen as a golden age of Judaism. So, yeah, even for Christians, it's seen as a very great moment in their history.
Now, one of the aspects praised by both Muslim and even non-Muslim historians as well was the overall theme of tolerance, particularly towards religious minorities under Muslim rule, like Jews, for example, and the Christians too. But was it really as harmonious as it's made out by some?
Well, society, in fact, is in constant flux. There's never going to be a totality of anything. You're going to find good moments and also difficult moments as well. But remember, of course, when the Muslims arrived in 711, the Jews were facing a lot of persecution from the Catholic Christians. You had the Fourth Council of Toledo, and Jews were forced into baptism, forced conversions, expulsion from the land. And Zain Zohar, a Jewish academic, says that when the Muslims crossed the Straits of Gibraltar, they welcomed Muslims as liberators from Christian persecution. And that's kind of a standard narrative, and in fact, not just to do with Spain, but also in Jerusalem and also elsewhere as well. The Maghreb after the Inquisition as well. That Muslims have always been kind of seen as champions of justice, you know, for other people. So therefore, Spain kind of, I think, is representative of that.
Now, during this period, Europe is often referred to as going through a dark age in its history. Muslim Spain, of course, was going through a period of enlightenment. What kind of role did Muslim Spain have on dark age Europe?
We have a kind of a juxtaposition, in fact, in historical terms and cultural social terms, because what the Muslims are doing, in fact, in Spain at that time of that darkness in European history is enlightening the world. We have the beginning, in fact, of the seeds of the Renaissance of Western Europe. Because Spain, of course, is in Europe. And you have, like I mentioned, the thriving of the culture of arts, of science, of botany. Seville, in fact, was known as the center of botany. Abu Bakr al-Ubaidi, Ibn al-Awwam al-Ishbili, very famous names, al-Ghafiqi, Ibn al-Baytar, Ibn Zuhr, Ibn Zawar, you know, very famous names. People excelling, in fact, in sciences, in geology, in geography, in mathematics, in astronomy. And then, of course, you have the beginning of taking these knowledges back to Europe, like from people like Petrus Alfonsi, for example, Michael Scott, who learned with the Muslims in Al-Andalus, in the schools of Toledo of Cordoba, and then took that knowledge back to Western Europe and began to educate the Europeans and their nobility about what the Muslims are learning, in fact, of these great sciences. And then, of course, they took it back, they enhanced it. That became the beginning of their renaissance in Western Europe.
Now, Doctor, final question. What can we, the Muslim Ummah, learn? What lessons can we take from this period in Islamic history?
Well, I think one of the interesting things is you have this Imam Ar-Rundi writes a poem after the fall of Seville, 1248, I think it was. And it begins his poem by saying, لِكُلِ شَيْنِ ذَاتْ مَا تَمَ نُقْصَانْ فَلَا تَغُرْ بِالطَيْبِ الْعَيْشِيَ إِنسَانْ فَأَيْنَ الْمُلُوكُ ذُوِ التِّجَانِ مِنْ يَمَنٍ وَأَيْنَ مَا حَزُ قَارُونَ مِنْ ذَهَبٍ وَأَيْنَ عَدْ وَثَمُودٍ. He's asking, like, he said, everything that reaches its apex, its pinnacle, will have a defect and a fault. Nothing is, the dunya, the world we live in, isn't supposed to, in fact, to be perfect. And he says that, where are the kingdoms of Ad and Thamud? Where is Qarun and his treasures? Where is Qurtuba? He says, upon all of them came an affair. فَكَأَنَّ الْقَوْمَ مَا كَنُوا. And it's as if, death came to all of them, and it's as if they didn't exist there in the first place. And that's a lesson, in fact. Every rule is temporal, is limited by vulnerability, by time. And so no one holds the keys of power forever. It's a lesson, in fact. I was in one of the trips I had to Spain. We visited the other city that was built outside Cordoba called the Medina of Zahra. It was named after the wife, I think, of Abdurrahman III. And 10% of it is excavated in the land from 1910 onward. That was the most glorious city. In fact, his diplomat was Jewish, Hastaa ibn Shafud, and he would invite other kings and nobles to Al-Andalus to spend of Islamic Spain. But the city is simply a loss, is a sign for us. And so I think that you look at two or three fundamental things. One, of course, is that having too much of the world isn't always a good thing, the dunya. And they had too much of the world. And all these examples in the Quran about the positive and negative kingdoms, like, for example, Suleiman was a good king, Dhul Qarnayn, a good king, but Qarun and Fir'aun were bad kings. And about the way that they appreciate and approach temporal power. The second thing, of course, is the difficulty of division. Once you divide, you become weak. Allah in the Quran, of course, is reminding the people, don't differ and argue, because when you're hurt, and that's weakness. And that's what happens. So dunya, one thing, vision, of course, is the other thing. And both of these, I think, affected the Muslims of Al-Andalus.
Unfortunately, Doctor, I have to end our discussion there for the time being. But thank you very much. We did appear to have some signal issues towards the end, but you passed on your points very, very well. And I think we learned a lot from that discussion. Well, earlier on, we also spoke to Muslim historian Asim Akil, who's also known as Tariq Trekker on YouTube. Tariq Trekker has filmed and presented an online history of Al-Andalus, which is available for all to see on his YouTube channel. We spoke about what happened to Muslim Spain after its tragic end.
I think the phenomenon of Islamic Spain known as Al-Andalus is great for many reasons. Number one, it can represent kind of like a lost paradise. It was a place where, or the first place in Europe where three religions lived together in peace for centuries, way before what we have in Europe today. I can remember listening to one historian on the topic say that the three religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, the people of these religions all have the same culture, which when you think about it, is very different to what we see today in the Western world. So it was very unique. Spain is a modern-day conception which comes into being after 1492. Prior to that, there was the Iberian Peninsula with a whole mix of ethnicities who would come in, whether it be Goths or Vandals, or Greeks or Latin people and eventually Berbers and Arabs. And the idea that it was a conquest, you can argue that it was a conquest. There are certain narratives as well that the Muslims were actually invited in by Count Julian, a Christian ruler from Ceuta, which is in North Africa. I think the time period of the Reconquista narrative finishes in 1492. That's when the reconquest is complete. The Jewish people, unfortunately, didn't flee. They were actually thrown out. The Muslims had a bit of a leeway for a bit longer, maybe for about another 120 years, but their life was made very difficult. Under the terms of the capitulations, the Treaty of Granada, the ruler, Muhammad XII, agreed to transfer power to the to Ferdinand and Isabella on the premise that the Muslim population could keep their religion, keep their properties, and keep their wealth. Within 10 years, there'd been a lot of aggravation by the Catholic authorities to the Muslims in the Granada region, so they rebelled. Ferdinand and Isabella claimed that this rebellion was in violation of the Treaty of Granada, so they did not have to show any more religious tolerance towards the Muslims. So they were then ordered to force to convert to Catholicism en masse, which the vast majority of people did. They kept Islam in their hearts, and they practiced Islam in secret in their houses, and outwardly, in public, they appeared as Christian. But the authorities were aware of what was going on, and slowly but surely, they started clamping down. So they started banning all Arabic books, burning the Quran, banning Arabic dress, banning Arabic customs, asking people to keep their doors open, their houses on Friday, so they could come in and see what you were doing, and on days which would have been Eid as well. And as the decades went on, towards the end of the 1560s and the 1570s, the way which these rules were enforced became a lot more stricter until eventually Muslims decided to go all out rebellion. We're going to declare our Islam openly and we're going to fight for our existence. This was brutally put down, and eventually the order came in the early 1600s that all Moriscos, and a Morisco is a Spanish word which means little more, a person who used to be Muslim, probably still is a Muslim, but Christian outwardly, has to be expelled from the Iberian Peninsula. So by 1613, the remaining Muslims were on the coast, ready to get ships to North Africa.
So a sad and brutal end to Islamic Spain there. But let's head back to my guest in the studio, Roshan Mohammed Saleh, for more on this. So, Roshan, of course, we've learned a lot today about Islamic Spain, and there's many positives that we take from that period and potentially some not so many positives as well, as we saw from the brutal way it ended. But tell me, do you think that Al-Andalus could serve as a model for a future Islamic society?
I think it's certainly a model for Muslims in Europe because of the nature of the... I mean, it was a Muslim society, it was Muslim ruled, Muslims were in charge, it was God-centred, but at the same time, minorities thrived. Christians and Jews especially thrived within that society. And I think, given that in Europe and even parts of the Muslim world, we have countries which may be Muslim majority, but there are lots of minorities there as well of other religions, it does serve as a model. It serves as a model of, you know, kind of, it's a reminder of what we could achieve when we were at our best. And I do believe wholeheartedly it can be implemented today as well. And the other thing I wanted to say is that I think this whole show has been a reminder for us that Muslims, we must study our glorious Islamic history. I mean, there were several golden ages, I guess. Sunnis would say the Rashidun period was the golden age. I know Shias might have a different conception of that. Then there was the golden age under the Abbasids in Baghdad. And I think the third and perhaps the last golden age of Islamic history was Muslim Spain. The Ottomans may disagree with that, you know, but there's arguments to and fro. But I think, you know, it serves as a real iman booster for Muslims to study our history. And it wasn't all a bed of roses. We had bad kings and good kings, good rulers, bad rulers, good periods and bad periods. You know, history is human, and Islamic history is human as well. But what I always say is the bad bits come from the humans, the good bits come from Islam.
Do you think that that's a problem, though, Roshan, that perhaps we're over-glorifying these periods when, of course, you know, like you say, they weren't perfect. They weren't a utopian society.
I think we should study Islamic history in depth, not just Muslim Spain, but the Ottoman period, the Arab period, all the different periods, even Muslims as minorities in the West. And we'll find good and bad. But I sincerely believe the good far outweighs the bad. But we shouldn't sugarcoat our history as well. We don't have to defend every aspect of history in Muslim countries, like slavery, for example. There's a lot of bad stuff that went on there. But that's not from Islam. It's from flawed human beings. And the final thing I want to say is that, you know, may the light of Islam shine in the Iberian Peninsula, in modern-day Spain and Portugal, yet again today.
Inshallah. Well, that might be an interesting question to end the show on as well. What should we be doing? Because, as you say, you're not allowed to go there and pray, for example. There's a bit of desecration going on. Like, I don't know, should Muslims do more about this? Should there be some kind of effort done to try and change the Spanish authorities' view on this? What do you think?
I think we need to raise awareness about, you know, how we're treated. I mean, I went to the mosque in Cordoba just about a month and a half ago. I did a little video saying, you know, the Christians have desecrated this place. And this is what we've lost. It's a reminder of what we've lost.
Do you think we should just go there and start praying regardless?
Well, people have done that. I mean, you'll get arrested. So, you know, I'm not encouraging people to get arrested, but Muslims have done that, and they have been arrested. And some have done, I think, been threatened with deportation or prison or something like that. Wow. I don't think anyone has been jailed, but, ridiculous. You know, they don't allow, they have security guards running around. I just think we have to raise awareness. And, of course, as Muslims, we have to give dawah, we have to invite the Spanish non-Muslims to Islam. This is what we have to do, you know, as Muslims, as part of our duty.
It's fascinating how the emphasis is on pointing the finger at how Islam behaves and how Muslims behave, apparently spreading by the sword, when in fact we see here with the Reconquista that actually Christianity was spread by the sword in this regard. Thank you, Roshan. We have to end it there. We could talk a lot more on this. That is unfortunately all the time we have for today. But thank you to all of our guests and for you at home. Join us again next week for another edition of Eye on Islam. Assalamu alaikum for now.
In the limelight. California Congressman Adam Schiff said that he believes there is sufficient evidence to criminally